And you're tuned, of course, to another edition of Money Matters, your economic forum. Thanks for being with me and joining me today. Discussions in this show should not be construed as specific recommendations or investment advice. Always consult with your investment professional before making important investment decisions. I'm an investment advisor representative through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Indices mentioned are unmanaged and cannot be invested into directly. Past performance is no guarantee of future results. Investing involves risk. Depending on the types of investments, there may be varying degrees of risk. Investors should be prepared to bear loss, including total loss of principal. The views expressed are my opinions only. They do not necessarily reflect those of Cambridge's stationed staff members or underwriters. Welcome to the 299th show, which we have entitled Impeachment Results on the Markets. Not what will happen, of course. Money Matters is about money, and money is matter, and matters of money affect us all in some way or another. Whether you have a lot of it, a little of it, or none of it, it controls our economy, our country, our planet, in some way or another, controls the very way we live our lives. It's about your money, your lack of it, or abundance of it. It's about our lives and livelihood. In short, Money Matters is about you. Okay, thanks for joining me, of course. 12:09 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, December 19, 2019, in the year of our Lord. And you may be hearing the show on another day. Not a day before this. That would be physically impossible. But after. It's carried on a variety of stations at different times. Our website, au gratis, no charge for the website. Anything on the website, moneymanagementradio.com, our way of this community radio station saying thank you for listening to Money Matters. There's market news and other things that you can see, and you can also grab past shows for no charge. So let's talk about the markets. Let's see what's going on here. Markets, 28,354, new highs right on the Dow. Okay, there you go. And as always, 28,354, if you've never joined us before, we always cover the start of the show with the major resistance and support levels. What does that mean? Well, at 28,354, the technocrats who believe such things usually will say that 28,000, the large number below us, right, we're at 28,354, so the large number below us, 28,000, is now a support level. So if the Dow was to fall, the 28,000 would be sort of a support for it. So say the technocrats, you cannot prognosticate which way the markets will go at any time or what it'll do. But those that believe such things think that 28,000 below 28,354 is a support level. The huge number above us is 29,000. That would be resistance. It would resist going through there. And 30,000 would be a major milestone, of course. Normally, in my opinion, and in what I've seen over, 40-something years in this market, is that when it gets to one of these big numbers, there are a lot of little numbers in between that the technocrats look at as well. But 28,000, the thousands, and of course the 10,000s number are generally regarded as real milestones. So 28,354, we have popped over 28,000. We've remained over 28,000 for a couple of days. So now we think the 28,000 below us is the support level. So we'll talk about why that may be happening. Saw something out today. It was kind of interesting. This is not a solicitation to buy or sell any security. Okay? So just remember that. But I am looking at a chart of BTC, which is the Bitcoin USD security. Not Bitcoin itself. It's put together by managers and such. I could read you the profile, but basically it's Bitcoin. It's sitting at 7180. It's down 1.55%. Bitcoin was very, very popular with investors early on. And reportedly, a lot of people made a lot of money on it. And it got over 10,000, and then to 12 and 13. It got all the way up to 18 or 19, I think. And then somewhere around July, it was around 12,285, and then 11,805 on July 30th. And since then, back down, it's gone again. And so there you go. I can't imagine. On the market wrap on Yahoo Finance, it says stocks fly, bonds sink, Bitcoin still looking bearish. What does that mean? Stocks fly, bonds sink. Well, generally, it is thought that bonds and stocks move opposite of each other. If stocks go up, bonds would fall. And if bonds fall, stocks go up. And if stocks go down, bonds rise. Now, that's not an exclusive movement. It can do the opposite, or they can move together, or what have you, and they've done both. So we can't judge on that. But normally the thinking is bonds pay a fixed rate. You know, they can pay a fixed rate, 3%, 4%, whatever it is. So when stocks are flying up, the thinking is that investors get greedy and they say, well, I don't want to buy a bond for 2.5%, 3%. I don't want to be in the stock market where I can earn 10, 15, 20% or whatever. Whatever. So it's not saying you will earn that amount of money in stocks, but generally thinking is they move opposite of each other. And so during 08 and 09, we saw stocks fall and bonds fall. So they can happen together. And so stocks fly, bonds sink. That would be typical. It's one of the reasons why, you know, I've got a preparation today of prepared presentation about management. And so normally modern portfolio theory, MPT, modern portfolio theory, says that diversification in a portfolio is recommended. So you would not buy, according to MPT, one stock for all your money. You would break it up between many stocks, and then mixed in, you would also buy some bonds or bonds funds. So if one goes up, the other goes down. One goes down, the other goes up. There are investors that just buy all stocks. They just buy all index funds or whatever they buy. And life is good when the market's going up. If you were to buy all stocks, life is good when it goes up. And the portfolios would normally go up. But in routes, there would be no counterbalance. Remember, if stocks are going up, bonds will sink. But if stocks start to fall, bonds may rise. So they mix the two to make sure that you don't going in one way, one direction or another. Now, if people could prognosticate which way the markets are going to go, you would just, whatever that direction would be, if you think it's going to go up, then you would just buy all stocks, right? And if you think the market's going to get hammered, you could go to cash, which has no volatility at all, right? No volatility. No volatility. There we go. No volatility at all. Still can't say that word. No volatility at all. And bonds would be thought of as to rise in a falling market. And so there you go. So we'll see, you know. Investors that are holding all bonds right now may see their balances decline. And investors that are holding a mix, which is what I personally recommend, a mix, and I think most advisors would follow that thinking, because you can't prognosticate which way the markets will go. If you hold a mix, the Dow might go up, you know, 4 or 5% or whatever in a month or 2 months or 3 months. Your portfolio would probably not go that much proportionally, because you're holding things that also go down, okay? So with that in mind, you know, have a preparation on advisors. Approved, number 276481. You guys don't know what that means, but the regulators hear that. So we're going to look about this. The markets have been running. So the question is, how is your advisor doing and how are they doing it? How is your advisor doing and how are they doing it? So let's take the case of two advisors, A and B, right? A and B. Both advisors start out with $100,000, okay? At the end of 12 months, advisor A has grown the balance of the portfolio to $106,000, 6%. Advisor B ends up with $103,000 balance, 3%. Which is the better advisor? So advisor A had a 6% gain. Advisor B had a 3% gain. Which is the better advisor? Now, I've asked this question at multiple seminars. The answer is usually the same. Advisor A is superior because he brought back 6%, while advisor B ends with 3%. But much like a young man taking your daughter out to the prom who arrives at the dance safely and on time, right? Teen suitor A, while another teen suitor arrives late, the end result does not mean the correct answer was the obvious one. One suitor arrives on time and the other arrives late. One advisor gives you 6%, the other 3%. In fact, the opposite could be true. In case of the first young suitor A, who arrived on time, perhaps he drove a little too fast. Maybe he ran some red lights and failed to come to a complete stop while transporting your precious little jewel. While suitor number 2, B, who arrived late, took his time driving more carefully. The same could be said of the two advisors. Much like the teen driver in the two advisor comparison, and how they manage the portfolios and their ending balances, the end result may not be the preferred conduit by which you place your money or put your daughter in transportation, right? The better question would be, how did they get there, right? It's true, the end result of advisor A bested advisor B by 100% margin, 3% versus 6%, right? But how did he do it is the real concern. The word risk, R-I-S-K, would be a key factor in this equation, as the symptom of that risk is what I call drawdown and take up. Okay, drawdown or take up. I've talked to many investors and money professionals alike, and more often than not, the end result is the main consideration, the only consideration on surrounding how one advisor did compared to another. One advisor made me more money. He's better. That is a serious flaw, in my opinion. Yet the underlying problem is this thinking will only be known when it's too late. I mean, well, you might think that advisor A is better, but you may not realize that may not be the case until you've suffered some negative consequences. The level of risk that each advisor subjects his client to should be, in my opinion, the main consideration when evaluating performance, right? Let me repeat that. The level of risk each advisor subjects his client to should be the main consideration when evaluating performance. In investing circles, it is sometimes called or referred to comparatively as the term beta. My daughter has a fish. It's a beta. But this is beta, B-E-T-A, where the fish is B-E-T-T-A. Beta, not the fish, but the market term, is the degree of comparative movement a security historically exhibits when the overall market moves up and down. Right? So, a beta of 1, it's just a standard accepted number. 1.0 beta. Okay? Let's say you have a stock of AYZ company, fictitional. And it has a tendency to move exactly with the market. Okay? 1.0 beta means the security will move with the market historically. Doesn't mean it always will. It's not a guaranteed predictor of. But historically, it has moved in lockstep with the overall market. So if the market goes up 6%, whatever market index you may be looking at to establish its beta comparative, if the market goes up, let's say 10%, if the stock goes up 10%, excuse me, that would mean that the market went up 10%. If the market falls 6%, this 1.0 beta stock would be expected to fall 6%. So it moves lockstep with the market. Historically, it may not, but over a long period of time, they look at it and say, yeah, this stock has a 1.0 beta, it usually moves with the market. OK? Okay, 1.0 is a constant, and it means that the security moves with the market. If you have a security that moves faster than the market, up or down, it would be have a beta higher than 1.0. If it had a beta of 2.0, it would mean it moves twice as fast, both up and down. If it had a beta of 0.5, which is half of 1, it would have a tendency to move half as fast. So a stock with the beta of 2, if the market went up 10%, the beta of 2 would be expected to move 20%. And if the security had a beta of 0.5, then it would be expected to move half the amount that the market moves. Okay? If you had a stock that was like a beta of 3, it would move 3 times the market. Beta is an historical value based on the past, and therefore is no guarantee of anything. It just represents what it has done. And if you take a, you know, a stock that's been around for 80 years, its beta is probably pretty accurate because the sample set of 80 years or whatever it is a large sample, right? If you have a stock that's only been out 6 months and you attach a beta to it, well, you really don't know. It doesn't have enough history. You can assume that a lower beta is less volatile, right? It moves, doesn't move as much, and therefore a more conservative posture. So if somebody said to me, I really want to gamble, then you might purchase things that have a beta of over 1.0. Now, options, right, which are really volatile, they may have extremely high beta. I don't think there's even a beta on them because they can move like a whipsaw. In options, you can lose everything in an hour. I suppose you could do that on a stock, but this is probably less likely. Now, you can surmise, you can figure out the beta of your whole portfolio if you want, right? Because your whole money is parked in a lot of different things. So you might say, well, overall, what's the beta of my whole portfolio? Right? Am I going to move lockstep with the market? Am I going to move not as much as the market, or am I going to amplify it? Now remember, in an up market, a high beta is great. You think the guy is a genius, or maybe you think you're a genius. But if the market moves down, pain will follow, especially if you have a real high beta, okay? Now, you can surmise the beta of a portfolio by adding the beta values of everything you have, and then each beta is multiplied by the percentage of the portfolio makeup, then divide by the number of securities in total. This would give you the beta of the portfolio. So let's just make it simple. Let's say you had 2 stocks, okay? And one stock had a beta of 1, and another stock had a beta of 3. And you owned 50% of one stock and 50% of the other. So you got half of 1 as a beta of 1, and half of 3, beta of 3. Well, you add the two together is 4. Right, because you've got 50% of each, so it's 4. And you got 2 stocks, so 4 divided by 2 is 2. So the beta of your whole portfolio is 2. If you got 10 positions, each position would be multiplied by its percentage. In other words, if you had 10 positions and they each had 10%, then that'd be okay to add them all together and just divide by 10. But if you've got more of one thing and more of another, then you have to take that into consideration as far as proportions are concerned. So, once again, you could surmise the beta of a portfolio by adding the beta values of each security and its percentage of the portfolio, then divide by the number of securities in total. This would give you the beta of portfolio. Continuing on, in the example of advisor A, advisor B, 2 advisors, A made 6%, B made 3. Drawdown means how much under $100,000 did the portfolio move at its worst time, at its lowest level? And take up, it's my term, means what is the highest level it reached. Okay. So obviously it moved all over like a jagged line. But the drawdown would be what's the lowest point on that jag. So in other words, you had $100,000 portfolio and you let it ride for a year. Maybe Advisors A portfolio got as low as $80,000. Lost 20% at one point. Advisor B lost $10,000. In other words, it got down to $90,000. So he didn't lose as much. Okay. The ending value of $103,000 and $106,000 is only the end result that is being evaluated. But you also have to look at how much did it move in either direction. What was its worst drawdown and what was its worst take-up? If Advisor A, who made more money, had a higher beta in the portfolio than Advisor B, it would make sense in an up market, Advisor A would make more money. In a down market, Advisor A would lose you more money. As I said, the example would be that Advisor A's portfolio might have dropped to 80 at some point. Advisor B's might only drop to 90. These are fictional values, of course, but it illustrates the point. The end result means little if you don't know how you got there. You might say, well, my advisor made me 50% in a month. Well, he could be using very volatile options to do that. That may not be appropriate to the level of risk or the situation that a particular investor has. So the question would be, in simple terms, what risk was the client exposed to using advisor A and B? Was that risk that the client was exposed to what the client expected, if he knew it, and what risk would be appropriate for the client? So what risk did you have in gaining your 6%, and was it the appropriate amount of risk for your situation? In an up market, like I say, Advisor A would likely yield better results if he's got a higher beta, if he's subjecting you to more risk. But much like our teen rushing through the prom with your precious daughter, all is well until it isn't. In a down market, the Advisor A portfolio would probably mean bigger losses. If a crash in the market was to occur, right? If a crash in the market was to occur, and there's an old saying, what goes up must come down. I also say that all is well until it isn't. If a crash in the market was to occur, Advisor B, the one with the lower beta in your portfolio, would likely be the driver of choice. And much like a vehicle crash, you wouldn't know how bad the outcome would be until after the fact. You wouldn't know how much risk you were exposed to until you saw the losses. At that point, if the market was or is or may have a tendency to correct, you may have wished you picked the slower driver. And I'll accept the fact that my daughter might be late to the prom. You're listening to Money Matters on your community radio station. We'll be right back.
Yeah, I'm the tax man.
and you're tuned to Money Matters. Thanks for joining us. Stevie Ray Vaughan in the background. So I was reading a little thing on Market Watch today. Becky Quick, a news anchor on business news channel CNBC, has said, quote, she's all but abandoning allocation any portion of her personal investment portfolio to bonds. So she's going all in on equities. The standard accepted mix is 60% in equities and 40% in bonds. But there have been news medias that have questioned that. Back in October, Bank of America declared the death of the 60-40 allocation with a research report entitled The End of 60-40, written by Derek Harris and Jared Woodard, in which case they said, quote, there are good reasons to consider the role of bonds in your portfolio and allocate a greater number toward securities. Anytime I see something that says the death of something, that's starting to be a little contrary, okay? You got to realize we've had a, 10-year run, right? And all in equities obviously would have a higher beta because bonds generally have a lower beta than one, generally, depending on what kind of bond you buy. Merrill Lynch, a gentleman by the name of, where's his first name? Well, let's see. They had his name in here. Merrill Lynch, somebody Sieg, S-I-E-G, S-I-E-G. Merrill Lynch's Sieg. I didn't catch his first name here for some reason. I didn't see that, but it's probably in here. He basically said his investment breakdown was currently tilted 80% towards stocks. So you have to wonder, you know, is that proper? They said there was a mention in this article about a generational rally. Well, so that leads us into this impeachment thing. Okay. Last night as I was driving home, and, you know, I knew that the president had been impeached. We'd impeached, I think, Clinton back in, I don't know when it was, 98 or wherever it was. And he wasn't removed from office. And so the thinking is, first of all, that the impeachment hearings were baked into the market. Now, when I was driving home last night, I thought, you know, I was talking to my son, I said, you know, I think there's about a 20% chance that the market will fall tomorrow, because I usually think that these things are baked into the market. Now, if it's a black swan is something that happens out of the blue, like 9/11. Okay, nobody can ever say what's going to happen. But if it's something that's known and expected, the market is generally thought to accept that and price that in prior to the event. So, case in point, the Dow coming up to the impeachment was really kind of running. And today it's currently up about 96, I think. About 100. I'll have to look at it one more time. And so I saw the futures last night. They were like flat. And I thought, okay, market's already accepted the fact that this was going to happen. And there you go. The market's Dow's up 95 right now. And so now it moves on to the next body. And the thinking being, nobody knows, the thinking being he will not be removed from office. He being President Donald J. Trump. Hope I got his middle initial right. That's the thinking. I can comfortably say, in my opinion, if it looks like he will be removed from office, the market would probably, in my opinion, not like it. But for now, we are seeing market's reaction is flat. I could say up 100 is positive. I don't know if that's true. I can say the fact that it hasn't fallen horrendously, that it's probably a positive reflection. It's generally considered if any of the more radical Democratic candidates get closer, like Warren or Bernie, that the market would sell off. Now, again, we don't know Nobody knows what will happen. But that's the general thing that I've been reading, is the market will sell off. So with the market up, you know, close to 100, then I don't know what's going to happen. It's interesting. You know, it's interesting. One of the things that may affect this is that the Feds, you know, have running a huge balance sheet. Now, what does that mean? Well, that means that the Fed has bought a lot of stuff with the money that they can create from the banking system and from other entities that the other entities may not have been able to sell. Specifically, in 08 and 09, there were a lot of mortgage-backed securities, mortgages that were bought by the banks, by the Feds from the banks to get them out of trouble, because the banks couldn't sell them on the market. So the Feds came in and bought them and gave the banking system and a lot of the financial institutions cash in return for that. And so when they buy something, it's kind of funny, you know, when they buy something, normally you would think of balance sheet as how much money they have. Actually, it's the opposite. The bigger the balance sheet, it means the more debt they have purchased, okay? So the balance sheet holds debt. So if you see the Federal Reserve's balance sheet ballooning, which it has, then you can just say, well, the Fed has bought a lot of debt from people. Okay? That's what you could say. The Fed has bought a lot of debt from people. And so when you see a balance sheet, I myself think of garbage heap. Okay? It's like me going out and feeling sorry for my neighbors and taking a bunch of money out and buying all their garbage, all their stuff that they're selling in the yard sales, and I put it in my garage. And I did that to help the neighbors, right? And the way I got the money is I just kind of printed it up. So now I've got a bunch of junk in my garage. So my garage's balance sheet is very high. I have a lot of garbage in my garage. I'm not saying that everything the Fed holds is garbage, but a lot of it was purchased when no one else would buy it during 08 and 09. Now, this Fed tried to unload. By the way, when they do that, when they buy things like that, it's called quantitative easing. Quantitative easing, okay? Normally, the Fed's garage was filled with about 800 or 900 billion of mostly treasuries, which is government debt, U.S. government debt, and it had some other debt in there as well. It got up to about 4-point-something trillion, most of that being mortgage-backed securities and other debt instruments from other than the federal government. And the Fed, about a year and a half ago, tried to unwind that. Unwind that, man. I opened my garage door, and I'm trying to sell off some of this junk now, okay? And they unwound about $1 trillion worth of it, bringing down to about $3.5 trillion just in the last year and a half or so. They've unwinding QE, okay? Well, what's happened, and we kind of explained this, what's happened is the something was going on in the plumbing of the financial system. We call that the repurchase agreement, repo market, okay? So what is that? Well, just think of a big octopus, okay, and it sits in the garage, okay, and it basically either hands out money and buys more stuff for the garage, or it takes the stuff out of the garage and shoves it down the banker's throat, okay? There's an agreement that basically says, I can unload treasuries to the banks if I want, or I can take some in from the banks. When I unload it to the banks, force them to take it, that's part of the agreement, then the banks have to give the Feds money, and the Feds take money out of circulation. They put it in the garage, and the balance sheet shrinks because the amount of garbage in the garage reduces. Well, the Feds had unloaded about $1 trillion worth of stuff into the banking system, and for some reason, the banks kept coming to the octopus needing more money for some reason. Now, they're very theories. You know, normally, this market is a big pool where banks and hedge funds and businesses go in and out of this thing every day. They take money out, and the next day they put money back in. And they put money back in, and the next money they take out. Because basically everybody needs money to operate. You know, the big firms and everything, they need money to operate. And so they have daily expenses, and some days they have more money, and some days they need more money. So you go into this market. Now, in 08 and 09, this market kind of froze up, and the Feds had to just keep handing out a lot of money. And they built the garbage heap in the garage to $4.5 trillion or somewhere. And that market has been running smoothly from 08 and 09. It did not require the Feds to manufacture more money and use it. Feds started to unwind it, unload the garbage, take money out of the system. And then somehow, for some reason, mid-September, this repo market started to come under stress, and there wasn't really enough money for everybody to dip into. So the Feds printed up some money and made an injection. It's the first time since 08 and 09 that it happened. There are a variety of theories of why this happened, but never mind that. Well, that first injection led to a second, led to a third, led to a fourth, led to a fifth, and so now they have put back, they've taken back in about $800 billion worth of garbage. Don't hold me to that figure. It's about what it is. So the Fed's balance sheet was at $4.5 trillion. They got it down to about 3.5, 3.6, somewhere in there, and now it's back up to about 4.4. So that hasn't happened. This emergency injection hasn't happened since 08 or 09, and it continues to happen. That is concerning. Now, of course, the Feds are basically saying, don't worry, it's no big deal. It's just part of the machinations of happening and what's happening in the world of finance. But, you know, I, in my opinion, know better. You know, when that repo market starts to require new cash from the Fed to be printed up, it's could be a sign that there is stress in the banking system. We don't know. You wouldn't tell it by the market going up, right? No. And the Fed is really not advertising that. The information is out there, but it's not something they put on the news. I used the analogy in an article I wrote saying, you know, when a big cruise ship has a leak below decks, they don't put it out on the public intercom. By the way, we've sprung a leak. You know, they try to address it without alarming anybody. And up until the point where it gets very critical, will they go on the intercom and say, okay, time to leave. So they are posting some of this stuff, you know, in the standard financial news medias that I read. But it doesn't make the evening news. It did in 08 and 09, but it hasn't yet. That's not to say it will, but it's continuing. And the balance sheet of the Fed, the garage full of stuff they bought, is growing again. And that, you know, the key point is that hasn't happened since 08 or 09. So what is going on? Meanwhile, the Dow reaches new highs. So, you know, the conspiracy theorists out there and everybody says, well, this is all just a big money game. And I have to say that I kind of agree in a little bit with that statement. You know, I kind of agree because, you know, the Feds have just continued to print a lot of money, and you know, with the market running to new highs, but the repo market requiring injections, you have to wonder what is going on. So I can comfortably say a few things. Okay, the market does not go up long-term over time in the future, guaranteed. We can't, as an advisor, say anything will happen. I can't tell you the market goes up over the long haul. It's one of the things the regulators kind of allow everybody to say. I won't say that. Feds don't allow us to make any prognostication, and saying the markets go up over the long haul is a prognostication. Why they allow some people to say that, I don't know. They shouldn't, in my opinion. The other common accepted fact in markets is the market will not go up forever. That's pretty accepted. You know, at some point, it will end. At some point, the Dow won't be there, right? At some point. So, we don't know. This is a huge long run. There's an old saying that the markets can stay illogical longer than you can stay liquid. That means if you knew the market was going to crash, and I can comfortably say that the market will correct at some point, And at some point, it will correct severely. At some point, in my opinion, because it always does. It always has. I guess I can't say it really will absolutely do that. I guess it could go straight up in a straight line for a million years. But you tell me whether that's really feasible. But at some point, things will be okay, and then it won't be. And so the question is they, you know, the fact is they don't ring a bell at the top. You don't, you just won't know. There are certain things that I look at that are warning signs, little flashing lights that say, warning, Will Robinson. And one of them is the repo market. Yeah, one of them is the inverted yield curve, which we talked about. There are other things as how much cash is on the sidelines. And, you know, I can tell you that CNBC reported that the outflows in mutual funds is extremely high right now. There's a lot of investors taking money out of mutual funds. Now, you would think, oh, well, that's a bad sign. Actually, the contrarians believe that that's actually a good sign. Because when everybody's in, there is no one in left to drive up market prices. So when everybody is in, there's nobody left to get in. So with money coming out of mutual funds, the market's still running. That means there's a lot of people sitting out. Okay? A lot of people sitting out of the market. And so the thought is the greed factor will come into play. If the market keeps running, more and more people will get into this market. And when everybody is super convinced that the market will continue to run, it may not. Anytime I see something on the, is the analogy of the Time magazine cover analogy, and that is anything that makes it on the cover of Time, as far as money is concerned, signals the end of it. 06 or 07, Time magazine ran a front cover, said Home Sweet Home, how much people were making on their houses. And that pretty much, for me, signaled the end. And then in 1974, 75, I think they printed something that said the death of equities, which meant that was probably the beginning. So if everybody's out, it's probably mean it's time to get in. And if everybody's in, time to mean everybody get out. Now, there's an interesting article that just came out that follows that same thinking by Warren Buffett, published today. Warren Buffett says, his famous saying is, be fearful when others are greedy, and then get ready to be full of fear. Be fearful when others are greedy, and be greedy when others are fearful. So Warren Buffett has said, from both a short-term and a long-term perspective, it's pretty clear investors have become greedy and to a fairly rare degree. Okay? Warren Buffett said, quote, it might be wise to be fearful when it comes to your portfolio. Now, I don't know if he's taking consideration that a lot of people are selling out of their mutual funds and the market is continuing to go up. The question would be, why is the market going up if people are selling the mutual funds? Well, the money's coming from somewhere. Markets go up because there's more buyers than sellers. That's why they go up. So they show a chart here on marketwatch.com. And it basically shows that the level of bullishness is at historic levels. Now, I might disagree with that, depending on what metric you measure. If you have a bunch of people coming out of mutual funds, that doesn't sound like everybody is bullish. So at some point, yeah, at some point, what will not go on forever will end. And we just don't know when and by how much, right? We don't know. So maybe that doesn't help you very much, but it does maybe lead to the thinking of bonds and stocks together held would be good, and probably maybe some cash as well. Okay, and finally, on to the fire insurance thing. I've got a lot of calls. Ricardo Lara, the insurance commissioner of California, came out with an edict 2019-2 that basically said, and a lot of people got confused on this. He said that he is issuing a notice of cessation of non-renewals and reinstatement of policies that were canceled. Okay, but that's not all that's part of that. so we understand. Ricardo Lara sat in 2019-2 that if you are in an area code or adjacent to an area code, zip code, 95945 is ours. If you are living in an area that was in a zip code or adjacent to a zip code that was affected by the three emergency declarations by Governor Newsom. You know, when he makes the declaration of emergency because of the wildfires, they basically line it out by zip codes. They said the following zip codes are under a state of emergency. Okay. Newsom made three such declarations on three different dates. Okay. So he basically said, if you are in one of those zip codes and declared an emergency or adjacent to one of those zip codes, and the zip codes are laid out on the Department of Insurance website, if your zip codes are laid out, then you cannot be canceled for a year. And if you were canceled since the declaration, they have to reinstate you with the same policy you had at the time of the declaration. Okay? So if the governor came out on October 27th and said these following zip codes are in a state of emergency and you live in them or adjacent to them, I don't know what exactly the term of that is, adjacent. If you got canceled, the insurance companies have to reinstate you, whether they're admitted insurers or not admitted insurers. Basically, if they're in state or out of state, they have to reinstate you at the same premium that you had when the emergency was declared. If you're in one of those zip codes, you can find out those zip codes. Department of Insurance has this letter. You want to try to Google up 2019-2. That is the edict from Ricardo Lara, the insurance commissioner, on what that means. So a lot of people said, well, I heard that they can't cancel me and they got to renew me. No, only if you're in the zip code that was declared an emergency or adjacent to it. The word adjacent, I'm not quite sure, you know, how you define that, but. Okay, so that's the skinny of it. So we covered a lot, and show 299. The next show is 300. What am I going to do with that? I might ask Paul Castro on board for 300. Our Zen Tech thing. Paul and I have great talks, and I'll have to talk to Paul about what we'll start talking about. Maybe you guys could send me an email. MoneyMatters@KVMR.org. 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 Give me some ideas on show 300. It'll be a monumental show, I'm sure. You have been listening to KVMR FM in Nevada City, show 299, Impeachment Results. Hope I've answered all your questions. Remember, discussions in this show should not be construed as specific recommendations or investment advice. Always consult with your investment professional before making important investment decisions. I am an investment advisor representative through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Indices that may have been mentioned are unmanaged and cannot be invested into directly. Past performance is no guarantee of future results. Investing involves risk. Depending on the types of investments, there may be varying degrees of risk. Investors should be prepared to bear loss, including total loss of principal. The opinions expressed today, the views expressed today, are just that, opinions only. They are my opinions only, or the opinions of the authors or guests I may have had on the show or read their articles. They do not necessarily reflect those of Cambridge's station staff members or underwriters. I hold insurance license OL34249 from the state of California. And our website, moneymanagementradio.com, is free. All way of saying thank you for listening to your community radio station. Have a great day, and go make some money. Get back.